I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Most of the news coverage about Hurricane Katrina has rightly focused on the plight of the people driven from their homes and businesses and the rebuilding efforts in New Orleans and on the Gulf Coast. But Hurricane Katrina affected other southern cities in big ways. Today we'll find out how Baton Rouge, Louisiana and Jackson, Mississippi are faring in the hurricane's wake. Harriet Tregoning, James Stockard, and Jennifer Leonard were three of the organizers of the recent Bruner Loeb Forum in Baton Rouge to discuss the growth pressures Katrina has caused in that city. John Lawrence heads Downtown Jackson Partners, which has gone from moribund to booming in the past 6 months. We'll be back to talk with our guest today about the impact of Katrina on life in two southern cities right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Harriet Tregoning is executive director with the Smart Growth Leadership Institute. The Institute, along with the Baton Rouge Foundation and the Bruner Foundation, just staged the Bruner Loeb Forum to discuss the growth pressures Katrina's aftermath has created in the city of Baton Rouge. Harriet is the former secretary of the Office of Smart Growth for the state of Maryland. Jim Stockard is curator of the Loeb Fellowship and an expert in affordable housing and community development, and Jennifer Leonard is director of the National Vacant Properties Campaign. Last month, you hosted the Bruner Loeb Forum on Redevelopment in Baton Rouge, and certainly the location of the forum this year was significant. Tell me, Jim, what are the issues in Baton Rouge that you explored in the forum?
Well, we were invited to Baton Rouge specifically to deal with the question of redevelopment. As you know, Baton Rouge has received a very large number of new residents as a result of the hurricanes in New Orleans and along the Gulf Coast. And the question of how to absorb that growth and what kind of vehicle, what kind of agency or entity would be appropriate to help with that process was the specific question they asked us to address.
You said, Jim, that your focus was on redevelopment, but with the influx of people in Baton Rouge, I'm a little surprised that your emphasis was not on development. Harriet, you tackle these issues all the time of development versus growth. I mean, what is the new development growth, or is it simply new development with abandonment, you know, someplace else in a city or a region? Tell me about the tensions in Baton Rouge regarding growth and development.
I think that you hit on exactly the issue. I mean, the point in Baton Rouge is that they have all this new population coming, and unless they accelerated their plans to revitalize the older parts of the city of Baton Rouge, that the new population would inevitably spread out to the fringes of the parish, and you know, be in a very low density automobile dependent pattern, and they would have missed the chance to have the energy of that new population revitalize the older neighborhoods. And so they very much wanted to figure out how could they really tackle this redevelopment problem. They had more than 6,000 what they call adjudicated properties, that is tax foreclosed properties that are the responsibility of the city, but do not have clear title for redevelopment, and that problem in particular was plaguing the city.
Jennifer, again, that's a problem you work with. Vacant properties, again, that become very difficult to redevelopment. 6,000 adjudicated properties in a city the size of Baton Rouge sounds like a lot. Is that typical? Is that a is that what you're seeing in cities all over the country?
I think that we do see that in cities around the country. I think the number 6,000 it does seem like a large number for Baton Rouge, but I think if you look at other cities around the country, and unfortunately we don't really know the number in cities throughout the country or on the country as a whole, how many properties are vacant and abandoned. I think the numbers we generally look at in some of the cities that are declining, you can look at between 4% and 6% of the housing stock might be abandoned. In cities that are further along that cycle, you might be looking at as many as 10% of properties might be vacant and abandoned. And that is something that the Vacant Properties Campaign looks to deal with.
And how do you get those properties back in circulation?
A number of the different ways. It depends on where they are in this cycle. I think these properties, again, they're tax delinquent properties. So there are a number of different ways that you can do that. I think one is actually foreclosing on the properties, getting clear title. You can then transfer the properties to someone else that wants to do something with them. In other areas, we look at code enforcement as a means to either get the people who actually own the properties. Some of the properties may actually be occupied, and if you look at code enforcement, you may be able to stop them from becoming abandoned. The key is to really find out where the properties are, what their situation is, and get them into the hands of someone who will do something with them.
One of the problems we face in many parts of the country, and we certainly heard about this in Baton Rouge, is the long processes that are usually involved in taking a property from tax delinquent status back to active part of the community. There are typically long procedures of notice. You can wait for a long time, a year, 2 years, 3 years, and an owner can show up at the last minute and keep the property alive again for his or her own terms by just paying some tax delinquent bills. Then this cycle starts all over again, and you have to start at the beginning. So one of the barriers is this: the arcane, I would say, in many states, procedures that slow the process down, even when virtually everybody would like to see that property redeveloped. There are state-level issues as well as local-level issues to deal with in the procedures of getting them integrated back into the community.
Are we getting a handle on those issues? Are we making progress?
I think that we definitely are. I think Jim is right about the length of time it can take. In some states, we've seen it takes up to 7 years to get a property that's been vacant and abandoned, tax delinquent for 7 years, before we can actually transfer title and do something with it. And so we try to work with states and cities to reduce that time frame, making sure that they're doing everything right along the way and notifying everyone that needs to be notified. And we've definitely seen reductions. There are some cities that can now do this in 18 months.
Harriet, is this an example of the unintended consequences of public policies that seem like a good idea at the time, but really prevent redevelopment in areas for which there may be market demand, and then creates or creates an artificial pressure on the edges of communities for new development when in fact we have old infrastructure that's perfectly good on which we could develop but simply can't get a hold of the properties because of public policy?
I think that is exactly the issue. And whether or not we're talking about places with a burgeoning real estate market and a big demand for housing like Baton Rouge, or places that are relatively weaker market cities, how you put vacant properties on the market and the quantity of them and their eventual disposition can actually affect the market conditions and the price that people are willing to pay itself. And so, you know, this is an issue that cities have to confront very thoughtfully and very carefully. Jennifer already mentioned that you might want to handle things very differently depending on the state of ownership and whether the owner is known of a piece of property that's tax delinquent, tax arrears, or seemingly abandoned, whether it's occupied by tenants of some kind. And then how, what disposition the property eventually experiences might depend on. It may not be a commercial redevelopment. It might be some other sort of community use. The point is that many of these properties are essentially blighting older neighborhoods. They're either not being used or they're not being contained and controlled, and they're in some neighborhoods open and used for criminal activities and other things that frankly aren't contributing to the health of the community.
We've quickly zeroed in on the issue of what to do about vacant and abandoned properties. Let's pull out a bit and tell me about the range of issues that were discussed at the Bruner Loeb Forum on Redevelopment. And I presume that those issues both reflect the concerns of the people in Baton Rouge post-Katrina, post-Rita, and also because you're all national spokespersons, actors on these issues nationwide. I guess Baton Rouge in many ways is a microcosm of what's happening really around the country. So tell me about, in addition to vacant and abandoned properties, the kinds of things you talked about.
Well, as Harriet has suggested, there was a bit of talk about where to redevelop, and some conversation about, I think, general consensus in the room that Baton Rouge doesn't want a lot of sprawl, but how do you intelligently develop in the more central city areas? There was some conversation. The most conversation was about the vehicle for doing this, with a sort of a range of options discussed, everywhere from let's kind of let it happen the way it will naturally in the marketplace. Maybe people will go buy these abandoned properties. Maybe people will acquire some properties that aren't abandoned and add them together to do some developments, across the range of what should the city's departments do. And we did focus a great deal on, suppose the city should set up a new entity of some kind to do this. One of the issues in Baton Rouge is that they probably got 3 or 4 decades of growth in a weekend. And so, unlike many cities which must deal with this issue in the face of a slightly rising or slightly falling population, they have to deal with this with some urgency. And a question about whether or not they ought to set up some new agency or entity, public, public-private, semi-public, that would act on the question of redevelopment beyond the vacant properties, but where and what and how should we do developments, mixed use, mixed income, et cetera, took up a lot of our time. What kind of public vehicle or what kind of vehicle would be appropriate for dealing with this issue?
And we brought in folks from around the country to talk about interesting examples from where they were working. We had some folks from Genesee County, Michigan, talking about the land bank authority that they've created recently and how they're using the land bank as the primary vehicle to do redevelopment of vacant properties. We also had Andrew Altman, who was the former director of the Anacostia Waterfront Corporation in Washington and also the former director of planning for the city of Washington, to talk a little bit about how, you know, what is it like in the early stages of creating a redevelopment authority? What are some of the considerations that you might want to make? And also, how do you interact with the planning entities that exist that are doing planning for the city, and how do those things work together? We had Jair Lynch, who's a developer in Washington, who's kind of a, even though he's a private sector developer, a for-profit developer, he's very community-minded in how his company works. And so we talked about what's the private sector's perspective and how do they work well or not so well with the redevelopment efforts that various cities are trying to undertake. And we also had Ann Coulter, who's the former vice president of the River City Partners, which is an interesting model. It's a not-for-profit private developer in downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee, that isn't formally a redevelopment authority for the city, but performs a lot of those functions as a nonprofit private corporation.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Harriet Tregoning of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute, Jim Stockard, who's curator of the Loeb Fellowship, and Jennifer Leonard, director of the National Vacant Properties Campaign. Jim, you raise this issue of how to organize, and, you know, there's nothing terribly sexy about it, but if you don't figure out how to organize, nothing gets done. Harriet's given the example of Andy Altman and how you think about the early stages of a redevelopment agency and River City Partners, very successful redevelopment agency in downtown Chattanooga. I have a colleague, Charles Landry, one of my favorite people in the UK, who wrote the book The Creative City, is working on a new book. And we talked a lot about the job of city making, and I'm curious, why do we have to separate the job of redevelopment from the job of city making? Is it really necessary to set it apart and treat it as separate?
It's interesting. That topic actually came up a bit at the forum. The short story, I think, about it, Carol, is that making cities is very, very complex. And many of the people who spoke to us, Andy for one, commented that when you're undertaking sort of significant size and scale projects that involve a diversity of uses and a diversity of activities, lots of physical planning, some programming, some the engagement of a wide range of stakeholders, that it's really helpful to have somebody who really focuses on that, gets up every morning with the idea, how are we going to advance this project to the next step? Now, that said, the next question is, how do you make sure, and again, this is something that was echoed at the forum by many of our speakers and many of the people from Baton Rouge, how do you make sure that that effort is coordinating in some really serious way with all of the other activities going on. That is to say, if there's not a university in the middle of this development area, is somebody nonetheless talking to the university about how they'll play some role in this? If there's not a big transportation issue, some streets, but not a big issue of mass transit in the area, how are people coordinating with those folks so that those plans are coordinated well together? So I don't think it should be separated. I think it's a question of focus and coordination.
Carol, don't forget that in many ways these properties have sat vacant and abandoned for years, sometimes decades. These are the toughest properties to tackle. So if it was the easiest thing to do, I think people would be doing it. And if you're the city planner or the transportation or public works director or the economic development or housing director, you have your to-do list every day. And this thing that's been on your predecessors and their predecessors' to-do list for the last 10 years, if they could have gotten it done, they would have. So I think their point was that you have to coordinate with the agencies of city and county government, but you also really need to have focused, sustained, creative attention placed on these types of properties if you really want to see something happen.
Well, and that makes sense to me. I think that what I was referring to, Harriet, would be the larger question of looking at the community as a whole. In other words, where does the concern for redevelopment match up with the demand for continued expansion at the edges? And are those two considerations under the same umbrella? Are they being considered as one and not separate pieces?
I think to some degree in Baton Rouge they are. And I think it varies in different places. But as you know, and I've certainly heard on previous shows that you've done, you've discussed the topic of kind of market making. The demand in the past was one thing. But when you can show people that neighborhoods that they never considered could give them a great quality of life and great convenience, great access to culture, to amenities, to more transportation and housing choices, suddenly where there was no demand for housing, that can shift very radically. And what a lot of redevelopment entities are doing across the country, land banking entities as well, is actually positioning to try to get ahead of the coming demand for housing. So they spend a lot of their time focusing on guaranteeing a future supply of affordable housing, knowing that that demand is going to be shifting.
One of the pushbacks that is occurring around the country on continued land expansion, continued development on the edges, is simply traffic. I mean, traffic tie-ups, traffic congestion, the longer times that people are spending caught in traffic. And I understand that's really been an issue in Baton Rouge. Was that discussed?
It was discussed a little bit, but that didn't seem to be a primary motivator for this, for having this forum. It certainly was a topic of discussion, and you're absolutely right, Carol. It comes up, all across the country. Traffic is getting worse and worse in most of our metropolitan areas with sort of no end in sight. So, a lot of the market shift that we were just talking about is coming from people saying, if I had a choice, my next move, I'd much rather try to live closer to where I work so that I don't have to spend so much time stuck in traffic.
Most southern cities are very late coming to the notion of transit serving anyone who can afford a car. And I assume Baton Rouge is the same. As you think about redevelopment, or as they think about redevelopment in Baton Rouge and encouraging what I would suppose would be denser and more compact communities, did they talk at all about the role transit might play?
Concurrently with this effort, with this Bruner Loeb Forum on Redevelopment, they're undergoing a massive South Louisiana planning effort led in part by Peter Calthorpe that is going to be addressing, regional issues, including transportation. And we're anticipating a significant set of recommendations to come out of that effort. And so we deliberately narrowed the scope of our discussion to redevelopment. But stay tuned. I'm sure that the Calthorpe effort is going to produce a lot of recommendations related to regional transportation and transit in southern Louisiana.
All three of you were there and helped plan this session. I'm curious, what was the mood of the people in Baton Rouge? Are they hopeful? Are they excited? Do they feel overwhelmed and exhausted? What's the mood?
I found that the people I was talking to, I'm sure they are exhausted, but everybody was more than excited to be there. And I think the excitement built throughout the day-long activities as we were talking about the different possibilities for them. I think they're excited to move forward. I don't know if anyone thought otherwise.
No, I think that's right. The mayor came to say a few words to us at more or less the beginning of the day, and we knew that he had a busy schedule and was likely to depart fairly soon after. But in fact, he stayed for the entire morning session to hear a number of the speakers, and I think got quite enthusiastic about some of the possibilities people are talking about. There's no question, Carol, that people who have slugged away in the trenches for a long time focus a lot on the barriers. When there's a new idea in front of them, they can imagine a couple of reasons why that couldn't happen. As Harriet said earlier, these 6,000 properties, nobody's in love with having 6,000 vacant abandoned properties in Baton Rouge. You can't get much of a vote in favor of that. So why hasn't it changed? Well, there are a couple of reasons, and the statutes are this way, and that administrative procedure is difficult. But I think, just as Jennifer says, by the end of the day, we began to see some lifting of the eyebrows a little bit, and a couple of more hopeful statements. And I do believe that conversations like this, which occasionally insert in the gentlest possible way people from other parts of the country who can say, well, you know, this kind of worked in our place and it might make some sense for you, is a good way to stimulate these conversations and broaden the boundaries of people's thinking just a little bit. I would say that the people who were all there were very respectful of the fact that we don't know Baton Rouge and that we can only suggest something that's happened someplace else. But I think that was a helpful part of the conversation. I think we might have measured a little bit of rise in the optimism by the time the day was over.
And Carol, of course, I think they feel a lot of pressure. I would say that they recognize that on the opportunity side, they have plans to revitalize Baton Rouge, and they were counting on a population increase to help make that happen. They just didn't expect it would happen all at once. So they're feeling the pressure of having the opportunity to implement their plan and not being quite as ready as they'd hoped to be when that population increase came, and at the same time the consequence of not being able to capture some of that growth in their hope for revitalizing centers means a generation of missed opportunity.
I want to thank Jennifer Leonard, Jim Stockard, Harriet Tregoning for being our guest on Smart City and for the work you did in Baton Rouge.
Our pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank
Carol.
You, Carol.
Harriet Tregoning is Executive Director of the Smart Growth Leadership Institute. Jim Stockard is Curator of the Loeb Fellowship Program. And Jennifer Leonard is Director of the National Vacant Properties Campaign. After a short break, we'll return to talk with John Lawrence about the impact of Katrina on Jackson, Mississippi, and we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Panhandling seems to be on the increase, and urban leaders are trying to find effective responses. Otis, have they?
They're getting closer. Cities have tried everything. They've tried getting tough. They've tried getting lenient. They've tried building housing. They've tried providing services. They've tried building databases. They've tried everything to sort of deal with the homeless. And what cities seem to be coming to is that there are two separate strategies that have to be pursued at the same time. And the way you do that is you sort of divide the homeless into two categories. One of them is, this will sound a little bit harsh to say, it's those who can be redeemed, those who are really down on their luck. They may have a drug addiction, but if that addiction can be dealt with, they can actually go back into the workforce. They may be parolees. There is a number of folks who can be redeemed and go back into the workforce and be, for lack of a better term, productive citizens. But there is a group of the homeless who are mentally ill, who have terrible physical ailments, who have drug addictions, or maybe all three of those, and cities are learning to deal with them in a different way. So the down on the luck group tends to be dealt with by a little carrot and stick approach, which is we're not going to allow you to do aggressive panhandling, but we are going to encourage you to get involved in a number of programs that are set up to help people reenter the workforce and to provide some temporary housing. The chronically homeless, that is those who are just will never be workers again, are dealt with in a different way, and they tend to be given long-term housing and intensive health care and drug treatment facilities, and the city does not expect them to ever reenter the workforce. And this obviously doesn't sit well with everyone. Some folks see that as coddling, and some people see that as being too harsh because you're not assuming that they can be redeemed. But the truth is, it is more humane to get the chronically homeless into these long-term housing facilities than it is to leave them sleeping on the streets. It dramatically improves the streets, the street life of communities, and it actually saves money in the long term because these are the kind of folks who just are constantly being put in jail or being put into emergency rooms because of drug overdoses. And so by segmenting the homeless and dealing with them appropriately, cities seem to be making a little progress here on this terrible, terrible problem.
Well, progress is something I think we would all appreciate because it's such a thorny, difficult issue for cities and for citizens to know what to do. And it seems like, again, the problem is on the increase. So I'm hoping these strategies work. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. John Lawrence is president of Downtown Jackson Partners. Jackson, Mississippi, like Baton Rouge, has seen a major growth surge in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
John, you run Downtown Jackson Partners. It's been several years since I was in Jackson, but the last time I was there was not much going on in downtown. I understand downtown is changing. Give me an update.
Just in the last 4 years, our office occupancy rate has risen from 89% to 92%, and this was before the hurricane. We've got 34 restaurants within walking distance of the core of downtown. We have about $150, $200 million worth of public improvement projects, a new conference and convention center. The conference center just opened. The convention center will start construction, hopefully, about this time next year. We have a new Supreme Court building being built. The state of Mississippi has made incredible investments into consolidating their employees within the heart of the capital city, which is big for us and big for them, but they're doing it with wonderful civic architecture to match the architecture of the historic Capitol building and the other buildings that have existed in the core of the capital city for 100 years or more. Those things are really exciting. But what we as Downtown Jackson Partners are most excited about is the shift from these public improvement projects to seeing the fledgling stages of private taxable real estate development going on. Because our office occupancy rate has risen, we're now we've got a handful of developers that are looking at new office buildings for downtown. So hopefully before the end of this year, we'll see construction begin on one, and hopefully in the next 18 to 24 months, we'll likely have construction underway on two or three office buildings.
How big is the population in Jackson?
Metro area is about 440,000 people. The city of Jackson is 180,000 people.
There are a lot of cities your size in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting any residential development now in downtown?
We are. We just opened two projects. There's a 10-story project that Entergy Mississippi had owned and occupied. It's about a 1925 building. The Entergy didn't need it. They had 30 employees in this 10-story building, and it had all the
one floor per employee.
Sure, it had all the problems that a 100-year-old building has. It didn't matter how nice the executive offices were behind the walls. It needed new plumbing, new electrical. The infrastructure in the building was terrible. They didn't want to be landlords. They didn't know how to use the building. They put it out for bid. And we did a lot of work with them, helping them understand their value as Entergy Mississippi, as not just the power company, but an economic development entity. And they grasped onto it and have been wonderful partners in the project. Duckworth Realty stepped up huge and put their own reputation and their own capital on the line to do this project. Renovated, it's a true mixed-use building. When it opened its doors, first floor has restaurants and a little bit of retailing on it. The middle sections of the building have two or three smaller tenants, and Entergy Mississippi moved more employees back into downtown than they've had since really the 70s. And then the top floors of the building are residential, really nice for-rent apartments. We have folks now looking at the condo market, but because of the historic preservation tax credits we're using on this project, it needs to be rental. Another project used that almost identical model. There was a building going through foreclosure. It was a 12-story, early 1900s building. Nobody could figure out what in the world to do with it. Peters Real Estate jumped in head first, bought the building, started moving on it, repositioned the few tenants that were in the building around, and they deserve a tremendous amount of credit for living through the redevelopment project. And the top floors of this building are now residential, waiting lists when they announced the project.
What was it that finally sparked this willingness to invest in downtown Jackson with some projects that of a type that had not been done there before?
It's a combination of things. Everybody sees the market. Everybody, we've been talking about it for years. And the when I moved to Jackson, Mississippi, I thought the first, you know, 2 or 3 years being down there, we're going to have to sell the story. We're going to have to help people understand what urban living is all about, the benefits of just being able to get up in the morning, walk down and get your cup of coffee and go by and actually purchase your newspaper from a person and see somebody walk to work and all the great things that come from that. Well, in Mississippi, that's not a foreign concept. People in Mississippi are, even the most rural people in Mississippi, are familiar with how town squares work, how main streets work, and it the concept of urban and community living isn't as foreign of a concept as I foolishly believed. And people were itching to do it. And the demographics are so hard to put your finger on because it spreads across the board. It's not what people say. It's like, oh, well, it's the young guy living by himself. It's everything from that young guy living by himself to the lady who really bad wants to be next to her church. And she's retired. She wants to live next door to her church because she goes there every day anyway. So why wouldn't she live downtown? And everything in between. And so the market and the potential was there. It took a few of these projects to really prove it.
When you compare your story in Jackson, Mississippi, to the story of your colleagues in the International Downtown mm-hmm. Association, is it the same story? Is that what they're finding?
A lot of times it is. Across the board, you can look at peer cities. Now, in Jackson, we look at peer cities like Knoxville and Shreveport and Baton Rouge and Little Rock, those type cities. It's happening in every one of them. It takes two or three things to really get it going on a large scale, and this is what we're moving into. Availability of the property. We just happened to, at the right time, fall into availability of some property. From there, you've got to have some willing investors that are pretty loyal to their hometown to take that first big step. And Jackson and Mississippi in particular, we've got a wealth of that. We've got folks that are willing to take that chance to prove the market, and that's what has happened. And from there, you've got to have some financial incentives. It has to be the same deal as doing a suburban project. We're not asking to give anybody a present to do business in downtown Jackson, but we've got to develop some incentives and have now a palette of incentives that can help with urbanization of our community, just to make it the same deal as buying a farm off the side of a highway somewhere, where it's going to cost $2 to $5 a square foot to buy a big piece of property. Well, that same piece of property downtown, if you could find it, would be $30 a square foot. So you're priced out of the market right off the bat. Construction costs on these high-density projects or higher-density projects are so much more than building a suburban development. We know we're going to top the market out on rents and sales prices. But oftentimes, in most of the peer cities that we're looking at, that isn't so much higher than the market as it stands already to make up for the additional costs of the project. So you've got to have some financial incentive put in there from a philanthropic or public entity.
What's the percent of the deal that mm-hmm. becomes the gap?
Depending on the project, we're looking in the range of 10 to sometimes 30%.
Really, 30%? Is it reasonable to really try to bridge that gap? 30% gap is pretty big.
What we're trying to help people understand is that if a municipality looks at it from an investment perspective, you can offer a tax abatement program. So there's no immediate cash into the project. You're just abating taxes that you're not getting anyway. You can look at tax increment financing. So as a certain district or a certain area grows in value, that money is funneled back into paying off the debt of some of these projects. Using your community development block grant funding instead of paving roads through a neighborhood somewhere, using that money to go directly into some true taxable projects. But everybody looks at that and you always get into the corporate welfare argument. The truth of it is, this is truly an investment. Well, we've been subsidizing, as taxpayers, suburban development for years. We help people grow into new communities where we're going to build the road, we're going to pay for the infrastructure, we're going to extend our sewer lines and our electrical lines out there. So the taxpayer's picking that up. If you just pencil it out, if you put that 10%, 20%, and even 30% into investing into existing urbanized communities, that money is money that, A, you're going to get right back, and you're not going to have to spend a penny on hiring new police officers, new teachers, new firemen. You're not going to have to buy a new fire truck. You're not going to have to build a new road somewhere. It actually, if you're just giving a developer, now nobody does this, but let's just say you give a developer 30% of his project cost, you're still, as a community, coming out ahead than allowing that investment to be put somewhere else that's going to cost you more money.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is John Lawrence. He's president of Downtown Jackson Partners, Jackson, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Traveling up I-55 from New Orleans, mm-hmm. Jackson's really the first city you come to. What's been the impact on Jackson of Katrina and Rita?
Right as Katrina passed and we realized the devastation, we already had a town full of people that had been evacuated from the coastal areas. The regular evacuation that happens with every hurricane, that suddenly had no place to go. They had no home to return to. In Jackson itself, the hurricane went through Jackson. And if you are outside of downtown where we have underground power lines on a power grid like most cities have, you had no electricity even in Jackson. We had to figure out how to handle all that and handle it pretty quickly. Restaurateurs leapt to the cause. It was a holiday weekend. Most restaurateurs were not expecting to do a great deal of business. They'd let employees go off for the weekend. They didn't have a great deal of food in stock, but they opened their doors anyway. I mean, it was hot outside. Immediately, right after the storm, we had restaurateurs just opening their doors to let people hang out where there's air conditioning, and they tried to sell them whatever they could sell them or give them whatever they could give them.
Because they were downtown and did have power because of the underground grid in downtown.
Right. And so it was amazing, and to see families that were in the restaurant business scrape together family, friends, anybody they could just to open their doors and let people hang around in their place, because that was the only place a lot of people had to go. Our real estate industry was amazing. I mean, it was so much fun to watch guys that you've sat across the table from in the most stern of negotiations start picking up the phone and figuring out how they could help. We had commercial office building realtors that knew this particular company, this particular law firm, this particular marketing company had a satellite office on the coast, or in Jackson, their office is the satellite office of their main headquarters in New Orleans. those people had no place to go, and they were finding furniture, they were finding more space, they were figuring out ways to do deals for 6 months at a time as opposed to 6 years at a time, and nobody was dickering over costs, nobody was pounding their hands on the table. They were just figuring out how to do the right thing, and that has paid off. That you know, you hate to think of it in these terms, but the truth of it is the people that stepped up in those first two or three days right after the storm to help the people that were displaced, that had no home to go to, those are the folks that are reaping tremendous benefits, because the six-month lease is turning into a year lease, or the three-month lease from a guy that says, I don't even have an office to return to or even a home to return to, has now decided he's going to stay in Jackson. We could have done that type of activity until every ounce of commercial space was dried up, but we ran out of places for people to live. Every home for rent, every home for sale, people were making deals right and left. Entergy Mississippi helped them figure out what they were going to do. They were headquartered in New Orleans. Giant office building downtown New Orleans that was not accessible to them. And, you know, it's been unfortunate for us in the telecom bust over the last few years that WorldCom had gone through its bankruptcy. Well, it just so happened there was a really large WorldCom building that Entergy could move into. That deal was made. Entergy was able to relocate. Those types of relocations ate into the majority of any available housing. And so once that was gone, we were stuck trying to figure out now how do we find places for people to live. We had companies calling saying, look, if you've got a hotel that's got 100 rooms available and a conference room that we can work out of, we'll rent it for 6 months. We couldn't do most of those deals because the hotels were already full.
You just reminded me, you mentioned conference room, and I want to come back to the conference center you mentioned that just opened. That sounds like a really good idea, and actually a different idea than a convention center, although apparently you're building one of those too. Tell me, is the conference center a civic, a public investment, and what do you expect to use it for?
It is a public investment. State legislation allowed an additional tourism tax to be levied on restaurants and retail that's associated with tourism. And from that, the conference center is being funded. The initial conference center, well, that's also funding the convention center. The initial conference center is a 74,000 square foot meeting center. It was originally envisioned to be a telecommunications conference and training center. We had so many telecommunications companies headquartered in Jackson before consolidation that there was a real strong need just to have a training facility. Well, as the dynamics have changed over the last 5 or 6 years, everyone felt strongly about moving forward with the conference center. It is a world-class conference facility. It has the ballrooms. It has the breakout rooms. It has a 400-seat theater in it. It has everything except for the clear span space that most convention facilities have. That is the next phase. The next phase to be constructed will be what will be known as the Capital City Convention Center, and the two facilities will work as one, where the conference center becomes the official breakout rooms in the grand lobby, and we build a much grander ballroom and a probably 65,000-70,000 square foot exhibit hall.
What are the biggest challenges to a downtown executive today in operating in a mid-sized American city?
Offering the amenities that our true competitor cities offer. Our law firms, our marketing companies, everyone that's doing business in downtown Jackson is competing with Boston and Philadelphia and San Francisco for the top talent. We have to offer some of the same amenities that those larger cultural anchors for our country offer. Now, we don't necessarily have to do that from having the best museum. We have to do it from having a good museum. We have a wonderful, wonderful museum system in Jackson, and the Mississippi Museum of Art has made a tremendous commitment to downtown, staying downtown and expanding downtown. But what we really have to offer is the lifestyle. We know we're not ever going to be Boston. We know Jackson, Mississippi is never going to have block after block after block of anything you'd ever want to do. But if we can offer three or four blocks of that, if we can offer an opportunity to live like I live in a former mercantile warehouse that had a train line running behind it, and my apartment is upstairs, and there's a bar and restaurant downstairs, and I can walk two blocks to the office. It's a wonderful lifestyle. It's not for everybody. We're not asking people in Mississippi to all go out and set their cars on fire. We just want to present the one thing that we don't have in our market right now, and that is a true urban lifestyle.
If you were selling, I mean, you say, as and you are certainly correct, that law firms and architecture firms and marketing firms in Jackson, Mississippi are competing for talent and clients with firms all over the U.S. and probably increasingly the world. What's the sale for people to come to Jackson, Mississippi? What's the sale for someone who could just as easily work in Chicago or Boston or New York to come to Jackson?
In Jackson, Mississippi, you're in a metro area of about 440,000 people. The second I walked into town, I was embraced by anybody who wanted me to be involved in anything. You don't have to be in the right family or the right club or grown up in the right area or have a pocket full of money to get involved with the arts or to get involved with music or to get involved with certain civic organizations. The community embraces anybody that wants to pitch in and do anything. Anyone with creative ideas, anyone that can separate themselves or distinguish themselves at all has an extraordinary opportunity to excel in a community like that. Most of our peer cities, that's one of their big selling points, as it is ours. The smaller market cities offer you a different pace of life, but offers you any type of opportunity that you'd want to take advantage of that you may not be able to get if you jump right into Chicago or jump right into San Diego or one of these other cities. In Jackson, if you're there and you're ready to work, there's plenty for you to do, and people are want to take advantage of that and want to help you exploit any talent you believe that you might have. That's based largely, I keep coming back to the arts and the culture of the community, and that's not something that I have a great deal of knowledge about. But if you see what has come from Mississippi and see what's come from the Jackson area, from music to literature to art, it's that opportunity that we now are seeing take place in the creative industries. And you look at that from a web designer or from an ad designer. These are creative industries, and the same opportunity that an artist may have had because he was inspired by surroundings, was inspired by what he was going through, had fought through whatever it was he had fought through to create a wonderful piece of art, the other creative industries are figuring out ways to capture that enthusiasm and show potential employees that they have that type of opportunity in a place that you may not have thought of before.
John, I'm glad we had a chance to visit. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
I appreciate it. Anytime.
John Lawrence is president of Downtown Jackson Partners. CityView's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
Community is a rhythm of life. Large and small, the life we share with others has a pace and a beat. Towns have a rhythm of events that keep us engaged and connected. The annual fairs and festivals, conferences and holidays, parades and homecomings, the fundraising drives, the school year, the sports teams, the seasonal activities and entertainments. All on a cycle we can anticipate and look forward to, giving us a tempo for life that waxes and wanes with a bracing stroke of engagement and animation. You can see this rhythm of connection among friends walking down the street in lockstep as they share a moment of talk and laughter. You can recognize it in the ebb and flow of the day. You know you are out of step when you arrive late to work and find yourself alone in an office garage full of parked cars. Your sense of the lunch hour is different when you get away at 2 instead of at noon. Indeed, you come to know different places by their unique rhythms. Dinner at 10 p.m. or later is typical in Spain, while rare here, for example. The flow of life takes on a unique character based on the rhythm that drives it forward. And when we lose our rhythm, our lives become jarring. When we move too fast, we become winded and overwhelmed. When we move too slowly, we become remote and dispassionate. A rhythm to community life is essential to sustaining our passion of place. But sometimes this means breaking up the regular beat with novelty and surprise. It happened in my hometown of Atlanta with the Olympics a decade ago. The disruptions to daily life were enormous, and not just during the games, but for years before with construction, planning, and events. The ordinary pace of life was replaced by a staccato march to the opening ceremony. Yet in its wake, the Olympics left Atlanta with a greater sense of itself and a renewed rhythm of community. The world came to town, leaving us with a new appreciation for the various rhythms that quicken the pulses of different cultures and people. Thriving communities cultivate a mix of the comfortable and the exciting. What's familiar keeps us grounded and stable. What's unusual enables us to stretch and learn. Communities built solely upon orthodoxy and convention shut themselves off from the diverse voices that can enliven and reinvigorate the experience and rhythm of life. Communities that shun variety and dissent get stuck in a dawdling pace that will only continue to decelerate. The rhythm of community needs a regular pace as well as an occasional step up to something that is fresh and revivifying. It is only with the latter that we can fully appreciate and improve the former. We recognize our own beat, not only by knowing what it is, but by recognizing what it is not. We learn to respect the diversity of other rhythms because they enable us to appreciate our own that much better. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, Inc. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvidge, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Eric Rudd edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.